Welcome back to the WFO Life Podcast. Today's guest is a second-round overall pick in the NFL 2008 draft, two-time Super Bowl champ, Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year in 2018 for his charitable work, including donating his entire 2017 salary to charity. This is a really special top-shelf guest on the WFO Life Podcast. Please listen up for an incredible interview with Chris Long. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission.
All right, good evening, WFO Life Podcast community. Today we got a special guest who we think matches up well with our focus here at the WFO Life Podcast, and I think a lot of you may have known him more from his prior line of work, but today we're going to focus on, you know, kind of like his work after football as a podcaster, philanthropist, and supporter of veterans and, you know, education and social causes. So without further ado, we'd like to welcome Chris Long to the WFO Live Podcast. Hey, Chris.
What's up, man? I've been looking forward to this. I know we've been going back and forth trying to find a time, so I'm just really happy to be on with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, it started out with a simple conversation between two podcasters, huh?
Pretty much. And, you know, I told you, I don't forget stuff. I have like a sort of an, I have like ADD, but I also have like the memory of an elephant. So yeah. I was like, I got to get on that pod. I said I would, and I can't wait to get on. So I'm glad to be on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And obviously we met at a dinner that you do for veterans. So before I forget, I just want to say thanks for you putting that on. And I'm sure we'll get into a little bit of the passions you have outside of football. So, you know, just thanks again for doing
that. For sure.
So I think Dr. Curtis, so obviously you got an active duty Marine Lieutenant Colonel and a physician. So hopefully this will be a fun, you know, back and forth. But interestingly enough, Dr. Curtis is more of a soccer fan. So yeah. So I don't know if you're turned into a soccer fan because that was the only thing on at some point.
I do like soccer. I like soccer, so I'm not gonna wag my finger at anybody who likes soccer more than football.
Yeah, so with that, I'll be nice and I'll hand it over to the doc to ask the first actual question.
Sounds good, man. Hey, again, welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming on. Like you said, I'll be honest. I'll say I'm a casual fan of the NFL. I'm not a anti football guy, though. You know, my time, I've spent a lot of time in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia in recent years. And actually, of all the teams I watch the Eagles the most. So it's kind of interesting. I know you were up there with the Eagles there for a while.
Yeah.
Definitely soccer fan. I actually have been an assistant coach with a USL2 team for a couple of years. So I've long, deep history with soccer. So I could probably go on for a long time with different aspects of, you know, professional sport and all the intricacies of that. And I know I have a few questions along those lines, but you know, when I'll be honest, I didn't know you by name. So I'm one of those guys that like, okay, this guy, cool. He's an athlete. You know, this is what I heard when Chris was telling me, hey, I was talking to Chris Long. And I'm like, okay, awesome. You know? Well, but then when I started looking into things, I thought, okay, yeah, high achiever, father's famous, lots of angles we could go there. But then I heard about, you know, the whole donating a salary to charity, you know, from the NFL, Chris Long Foundation. Then I started watching the videos on the Waterboy charity. I got super excited to connect with you. So, because I think that stuff is extremely powerful, yeah. And it fits with a lot of the things we talk about with our podcast listeners. We talk about mastering self, mastering craft, and accomplishing any mission. I actually think you're kind of a guy that's kind of jumped in at all those levels to some extent or the other. And especially accomplish any mission. I guess my first question for you is, why and when did you decide to get involved with causes outside of football? Let's talk, yeah. You know, all your work.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me is, and you touched on it, you know, my pops played 13 years in the league, Pro Football Hall of Fame, tremendous player. And I think in a few ways that kind of shaped who I was. Obviously, I'm not just going to say my dad did, but the circumstance of who my dad was, as well as who my parents are and their value system. But number one, my dad didn't come from a lot. My dad grew up in South Boston in a fairly turbulent situation, inconsistent home life, bounced around. And so I was always, I'd like to think, grounded because he had that perspective. But also, the fact of the matter is that anything I achieve in football is likely, you know, I've had a career that 99% of pro football players would envy. But, you know, when your dad's in the Hall of Fame, you're never going to feel special. And that's a good thing. Right. Yeah. You know, I don't, there's nothing I've ever done that I felt like, oh, I just made it. You know, right. And that includes accolades off the field and that sort of thing, because, you know, at the end of the day, number one, you're just an athlete, and that's not who you are. That's what you do. And I believe that across the board with most professions. Now, there's certain vocations that you follow those vocations, and, you know, that counts for your character in a good way, right. Whether it's somebody who serves our country or a doctor or a firefighter or a teacher. I think that those things are generally good indicators of your character. Football doesn't have to be an indicator of your character. You can be one of the best football players in the world and be an asshole. And, you know, the fact that my dad not only had his upbringing, but his career experience reinforces that I'm one lucky, you know. And I just have to have perspective and also realize that I need to humble myself and not waste a great gift, which was, and I worked hard. I don't put football as, you know, some gift, like I hit the genetic lottery. We're all talented.
Right.
I worked my ass off. I'll never apologize for it, but it's a gift because people would kill to be, you know, running out of the tunnel at the link or playing two Super Bowls. I need to do something with it to use my platform, or I've wasted it. So I think not only my dad's experiences, my family background, but just the perspective to realize that, like, I play football. That's not who I am. Who I am is what I do when I'm off the field.
Right.
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me, I think a while back, I can't remember if it was just before or just after I met you, Chris, but when I think it was in the Waterboys documentary where you said something about football was not fulfilling enough for you. And I think you just alluded to the fact, like, why that is. But I think for a lot of people, especially nowadays, I mean, being a professional athlete, they see that as the pinnacle. So I think for you saying that, you know, says something about who you are. But I think as a follow-up to that, as a military person that's towards the end of my career, and I think Nate Boyer and some other folks that have military and NFL experience have talked about it, that, you know, that transition from something that's kind of the pinnacle. I mean, if you're, you know, active duty, like I'm active duty Marine Corps, and I've read about how tough it is to leave something like the Marine Corps mm-hmm. and find something to fill that gap. And I feel like, is that something that you were concerned about when you were leaving the NFL?
Absolutely. I was afraid. I spent half my career in fear. I spent half my career in fear of failure, of, you know, not reaching my potential, of the transition after football. And I know some people mm-hmm. say, I don't fear, you know, that's just not the way I live life. And that might work for them. But mm-hmm. I've been motivated by fear at different points in my life. But I've also decided that I'm not going to let it grip me. And there was a point where, as I'm, you know, staring at the other side of, you know, this doorway. And when you're a football player, when you're on the other side of 28, every year you're thinking, could be me having to hang it up next year. Could be an injury. You never know when the wheels fall out from under you. You have to be ready. And then coupling that with the health concerns, I mean, there's a lot of fear that goes into thinking about life after football. And it can grip you. But I think the biggest fear is the existential part of it. You know, what's my purpose? Who am I? And I was as well-rounded as any guy that I knew on my teams that I played on mm-hmm. in life. You know, you can round out your life in a healthy manner without deprioritizing your craft. And that's what I always tried to do. But even with that being said, it gripped me for a long time. And I think sometimes the way you walk away can help. I walked away in a way that was really healthy for me. I walked away on my terms. I walked away with something left in the tank. Mm-hmm. And part of me wanted to ride it till the wheels fell off, but I also didn't want to be like my dad and not be able to go hiking or play catch or play pickup basketball after the age of 43, mm-hmm. because I've had 13 surgeries and, you know, I can't move my arm and my neck. I have to get that, you know, surgery on that or a back surgery. You know, I want to be able to be there for my kids. And that was one of the reasons I waited for a long time. My wife and I waited for a long time to have kids. My oldest is Waylon. He's 4 years old. I got Luke, who's a year and a half, and I'm fresh out of football. So I think the big thing is planning your life, trying to round it out, having a plan for what's next, and then not being afraid of the existential crisis, because again, reinforcing it, like, this is not who I am, it's what I've done. But then the question is, who are you outside of football? And that's something you got to grapple with. And a lot of that has to do with not only finding your purpose, but wrestling with your ego. Because, like, your ego is a big part of whatever you do. I don't care who you are, you know? Right. And so for me, and any football player, and you can watch football players, and, you know, I never liken men and women in the military and football players. I'll give that disclaimer one time. Hopefully everybody gets that. But there are some commonalities in the brotherhood as far as, like, the camaraderie. Nate Boyer and I have talked about that. That's why we did Conquering Killy. There's a greater purpose, something bigger than yourself that you've answered to for a while. One's obviously life and death. One's a game. But people depend on you. And so I think guys miss that. And you can see them struggle with it when they get out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, people lose mission when they change from one career to another. There's lots of folks that listen to our show that are in the middle of a change of, you know, the career. They've lost jobs. There's a lot of situations like that. When you mention the fear stuff, can you talk through maybe some, yeah, how did you deal with that? Like, one thing I like to do is try to stay in the present moment, meaning a lot of times people are daydreaming about things in the future, anxiety, yeah, about things that really, they're real, they're not real. Yeah. It could be good or bad, but I think it helps to be in the present moment. What kind of tools or how did you deal with, okay, I got this stress, I got all this stuff coming up. How do you avoid being gripped by fear all the time?
It's hard. It's really hard, especially I'm someone with anxiety, just
right,
general anxiety, not like crippling or anything like that. And I've spoken about that, but it's just, and a lot of the ways that affects you is you can't stay in the present, whether you're overthinking something in the past and right, regretting something, right, or you're trying to plan out your life right now. I think a lot of that is, and it's not that like I was a control freak, but for a long time as an athlete, you have to control your life. You have to right, control your craft. I have to control my regiment. I have to control, you know, what I put in my body. I need to be able to predict. I'm on a very regimented schedule. I know my entire year flow, you know, and I would get away from my teammates for 2-3 days on a bye week and get depressed.
All right.
Like, feel weird, you know, like, and coupled with that, you know, what we're fed as pro football players is that we're all going to go crazy and kill ourselves 20 years right, down the line, right, or we're right, going right, to die at 60, which I don't think is true. I believe in head trauma. I believe in CT. It's a totally real thing. But I also think there's this existential part of it, and some of it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're told you're going to go nuts, you're afraid of that. And sometimes, you know, you're suffering from a very emotional reaction to being away from your craft or the distance you feel from that purpose.
Right.
And you say, oh, I'm going crazy. I'm losing it. This is it. Like, but what helped me is looking backwards and saying, in the rough spots coming out of retirement, I had those moments where I was, you know, highest highs, playing in front of 60,000 people, happy as can be. I was happiest at work, grinding long days. And then when the dead periods came for 3 days, I was miserable, or I was right, feeling depressed, or I was anxious. And then I'd go back to work and that would remedy it. So I'd say to myself, well, this isn't, you're not losing your mind. You're afraid. You're afraid of what will happen when that bye week turns into the rest of your life.
Right.
And so I think the biggest thing, and I've learned this as I've retired, is number one, grappling with the ego. That's a whole thing in and of itself. I'm sure, you know, men and women who have served could identify on a much greater level of, you run on intense praise and reprimand for your performance for the longest time. And you guys don't get the intense praise that we do. And that's unfortunate, but you know, 60,000 people cheering, that unlocks a very primal feeling and you feel good about yourself. And when you fail, they're going to let you know it. Fans are going to tell you you're a failure. People are going to call you names. People are going to question your work ethic, your durability if you get hurt. When it stops, life is just even keeled. And guess what? That's okay. The highs aren't as high. The lows aren't as low. And I'll take that any day of the week, actually. It's better for my family. It's better for my mental health. And the key is just accepting that I don't have to plan the rest of my life right now. And I tell it to my brother because he just got out. And, you know, sometimes I can feel it. He's like, I need to plan everything right now. And you don't. Just relax. I know you've never been able to. I know you've never had time where you could just be like, I'm going to sit around for a week, spend time with my family. I don't need to plan the next month. That's scary. but it's liberating, too, if you get it right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go off a little bit of a segue here, Chris, but I think it's relevant because of some of the things you said. But I know, you know, I do some work with the Travis Manion Foundation, who's, you know, based out of here in Philly. And one of the things that we do is try to give, especially transitioned veterans, a different mission, you know, to kind of, you know, I guess, fill that void. And one of the things that they really did some looking at was something you touched on, positive psychology. So it's like a lot of times, you know, people say, hey, you know, you need to work on your weaknesses. And they really focus on, okay, what are your strengths and how do you, you know, continue to employ them in different ways, you know, outside of, you know, in this case, the military or football. But, you know, we recently did a kind of a discussion of a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And it was written by a Holocaust survivor that was a physician. And, you know, he basically came up with a whole line of psychology that talked about finding your purpose, you know, thus the title of the book, Man's Search for Meaning. And he would treat people's, you know, psychological challenges just by saying, hey, you know, you have a purpose and it can, and you have like, you know, small micro purposes and you have macro purposes. So I think, you know, what you said really resonated to me with something on a recent episode is that kind of, hey, if you don't find the meaning of, you know, why you're here and what your purpose is in this phase of your life, I mean, you're going to flounder and have some serious issues, right?
Yeah. So, I think what you said is true. And then sometimes realizing that just because I was really, really good at something, or I poured my life's work into it, doesn't mean it's necessarily my destination. You know, I might be more impactful or happier or more fulfilled in my second life or my second career. And I might find that maybe my function all along was to be more intellectual or something. If that's, I mean, as crazy as that sounds, to be a big meathead football player. I enjoy podcasting and learning about the world and talking to people as much as I enjoy playing football in some ways. I mean, especially day to day, you don't get the big payoff you get on Sundays, but I'll take sitting in my room all day reading and calling friends and having them discuss real issues and formulating, you know, takes and watching film and stuff. Like I like that. It replaces the grind and sure, you don't get to run out of the tunnel on Sunday, but maybe that's just as much my calling as football was. And I don't care if I have X amount of listeners and that pales in comparison to how many people cared that I played football. It's all about the lens that you look through. And for me, if I just remove myself a little bit from that identity thing, then it allows you to open up and see like, okay, well maybe you got something else in you and that you haven't unlocked.
Yeah, I think along those lines, the question that the kind of next question I had is like, you know, are there habits or tools or behaviors, you know, from your prior life as a high level athlete that have translated into your new role, your new missions, I guess?
I think more than anything, and this is something that my dad instilled in me, was take pride in everything you do. There's nothing to a fault that I work on that I don't want to be as perfect as it can be. And I'm not a perfectionist in a real type A way, but I'm going to grind it out until I feel good about it. And I'm a details guy, at least in my work. Now, My wife would probably tell you differently. The way I forget things around the house, or yeah, or, you know, I might be forgetful, or sometimes I have selective hearing and that sort of thing. But when I'm applied to a task, and this is something, again, to a fault, because one of the biggest skills you got to learn sometimes is to try not to be perfect at times, because you just get stuck on one thing and you can't get things done and prioritize your time and that sort of thing. And that's one thing I'm learning, because when I was a football player, it was always one goal, you know, and every minute I spend, more is more. And as I do podcasting, or I have a list of a laundry list of things to get through in a business week, sometimes like suppressing some of that urge to just more is more, everything can be a bad thing. But finding the balance of taking what I learned in football, the discipline, the dedication. I know one of my calling cards playing football was to outwork people, you know, on the field. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't always the most talented, but I outworked people. And I can do that when it comes to podcasting. And if I'm thoughtful and I'm true to myself, you know, hopefully that'll rise above some of the voices that are former athletes, because it is a blessing to be an athlete, because automatically you draw people to your podcast just for what you've done. And that's not necessarily fair to everybody else who could have quality podcasts. But I think just taking that work ethic thing and just fine tuning it a little bit.
You know, Chris, one of the things, I was a collegiate athlete. I had some much more famous teammates like Michael Johnson and Raymond Pierre and some other guys.
Wow.
Made pretty big splash in the world and sport. And what was interesting you just said is what we used to call the grind. And to be an elite level athlete, there's a certain amount of boredom and monotony you have to get used to. And of course, work, just raw ability to move the iron or do the reps or whatever. And what's interesting about what you just said is that still bleeds over into everything.
Yeah.
It bleeds. If you're building a podcast, you know, we've all done the, hey, how do you start a podcast? How do you do this kind of thing? Well, one of the success things is this turn out product. Keep pushing. Be
consistency.
Consistency, right? They all say that. And so, you know, much like I'm sure your program, we've done the same thing. Just be consistent. Just do the work. And what I've found is from my sport background and my running training background is it just is a natural, like, okay, this is the new grind.
Yeah.
Now you just transfer that over.
And there's still time to get my, you know, my wild hair out when it comes to just physical, the physical grind. I'm going to go run up this hill today called O Hill. We used to run it in college until we puked. And now I find myself where I used to dread waking up at 5 a.m. to go doing it. I go do it on my own. So that's never going to leave.
Right.
But it is about find a craft. I had Al Groh was my college coach and somebody that I value a lot as a mentor, as damn near like a second father. And I stay in touch with him still. He's an older guy, a lot of experience, but he always told me, you'll never replace football. You'll never replace it, but you have to find things that you can replace that pursuit of excellence in.
Right.
Fields that you can replace that feeling of, because, you know, you love football, but you love the feeling of achievement. Like, hey, I did it. At the end of the night, you go home, you look in the mirror and you say, because that's all that matters is the man in the mirror. And you learn that in retirement too, because people stop giving a shit about what you did on the football field.
Right.
And so you got to grapple with, are you satisfied with it? Because the game goes on. Your first fall out, you're going to look at a bunch of players and you're going to realize that just new ones are coming in. And there's going to be a new Chris Long. You know, there'll be a new Malcolm Jenkins. There'll be a new, you know, you name it.
Right.
And so I think just coming to grips with that, finding something to replace it, and then applying yourself in the way that you applied yourself in football or whatever your vocation was. And then quite frankly, realizing that you were that person before you took a football field. Because by the time you step on an NFL field, I truly don't believe that most people develop into people with different work ethics. I really think that there are rare cases where you might have a vet that can get to a younger guy and change his course or that sort of thing. But most people, when they're 22, 23, outside their rookie year, they are who they are. So I was always a worker. I was always a grinder. And I'm just leaning on the same things that I did even before I got in the league. And that's good, because that just reinforces the fact that, like, football is what you did. It's not who you are. You were that person before you took on that challenge, and that's just a part of your life.
Absolutely. Hey, Chris, I was wondering about. I got a friend of mine that's he's got a PhD in elite athlete development. And one of the things that we were kicking around thoughts that we just would love to hear from your perspective. You've been in a lot of elite locker rooms. What is the best training sort of athletic educational environment you experienced, and what does that look like exactly?
From a standpoint of a locker room, as far as the dudes or
The program, the attention to detail from the coaches, periodization, these types of things.
I think New England was really on target with a lot of stuff. I also think that sometimes I haven't been in one program that was 100% right on. I think that you take pieces from a lot of different cultures that you've been a part of. You know, when I was in St. Louis, I played for four or five different coaches because we weren't very good. 8 years, 7-9 was the ceiling, and that was like an astronomically good year. So the turnover there, I never really got, you know, into one system other than Jeff Fisher's, and there was a lot of positive there. And then I went to New England, and I thought New England was great because they truly spared no expense in investing in their most important resource, which is players. I mean, that's the product you're putting on the field. You know, this is something that I think some people might from the outside look at it and say some of the things you're listing, that's diva-ish. But you're asking grown men to go out and be their best on Sunday and play an extremely physical sport. It's car accidents every week. So everything that you do, from investing in your training room, the equipment, the facilities, everything being purposeful. Players need purposes. Like, I like when players say, why are we doing this?
Right.
You know, because I want to know why. Like, I have 24 hours in my day. Why am I doing this? Why am I using this modality? Why am I in the weight room? Why am I doing this exercise? And I know that can be annoying for some figures of authority, but as a player, you know, it's a performance business. And when I was in New England, most things they did were purposeful. Even to like the team plane, which isn't a given, that you might take a 6-hour flight across the country to go play somebody. Well, what about Alan Branch, who's 6'6", 360 pounds? You think he wants to sit and coach in one of those little sardine seats? You think that's good for his hip flexors, his back? Some people are going to look at that and be like, well, who gives a shit? These guys are paid millions of dollars. But if you want a good product on the field, and the Patriots did, you move the bigger guys, the older guys, the vets, to the front of the plane in the bigger seats. Who cares if it's first-class coach? Coaches are going to sit and coach, and that includes Bill Belichick,
right,
who's – the greatest coach of all time. He's back in coach, so we could sit in the front, so our performance is better. You know, whether it was the meals, they had a 5-star kind of chef set up there with the healthiest food. There was no, like, when I was in St. Louis, they'd just bring tacos, and then they bring barbecue the next day, and then Chinese food the next day, and they just rotate it. And that's what we're fueling our bodies with.
Right.
You know, so in a way, it seems like diva-ish or I'm bitching, but everything matters. Every detail matters. And that's why I love players that get in the league and they're not disrespectful. They ask why. Just tell me the reason so I can understand this process and understand why we decided to do this and not the other thing. And New England's a good place for that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I served with a guy who played football at the Naval Academy, and he went back as a coach while he was still on active duty, which is a kind of a cool, rare thing to do. But he mentioned that Coach Belichick would come to the Naval Academy in the summer sometimes and look at his dad's old papers, you know. And I mean, like you're saying, Chris, I mean, the most successful coach already of all time, he's going back to his dad's papers from the Naval Academy, and his dad was never even a head coach. And so I think that shows what you're saying. I mean, the investment in those attention to detail is like, well, maybe dad had a notebook that, you know, covered this one detail that I can't seem to get right. So that shows the obsession right there. That's a, you know, a personal story.
Yeah. And he's certainly one of the most detailed coaches, exhaustively detailed. He can walk around the field and coach, you know, the positions individually better than the position coaches, and they have some great position coaches, probably save for Dante Scar is what they called him. He was a legendary offensive line coach, but you know, Bill can walk around the coach and or walk around and walk over to the D-line section and make a coaching point and just walk off, and he can give you the best coaching point you had all day. So every angle is important to him. You know, every angle of the facility, every angle of football, and that's hard for a head coach. That's why it's really rare to have head coaches that are very detail-oriented. Now, there were things in New England that I didn't love all the time, but they were the closest to, as you asked, you know, arming us with the best resources to get the job done. And, you know, we worked hard, but I also knew that we had the best of the best, and that's what it takes to win.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Chris. I think a lot of our listeners are going to identify with that for the things they come to us for. But I wanted to ask one, you know, lighter question, or, you know, it could turn into a little headier question. But I was curious why you decided to move back to your hometown, your college town, versus some like more media hub or, you know, something that maybe, I guess, a better setup for your post NFL endeavors.
Yeah. Again, I think, the important thing to me is that my life and my family and my happiness is the most is central. And I grew up in Charlottesville. I moved here when I was 8 years old from California, where my dad finished his career with the LA Raiders, and he was with Oakland before that. But this is home for me, and I just love the place. And ever since I was in the league, and even while I was in the league, I used to come here every bye week. I got a chance, I'd sneak away for a 3-day weekend. In the off season, I'd be here. You know, I need to feel like I have a home, and I still am tight with my high school buddies. Although social distancing has screwed up our camping trips and and beer drinking, but you know, that's something that I value above anything else. Because I can honestly tell you that during my whole career, like, I had some awesome moments, but my career never was more important to me than where I'm from or the people I knew before I played football. So getting back to home, if I didn't compromise that in my 11 years in the league, why would I move to like Connecticut or something? Nothing against Connecticut. Get a job at ESPN, where not only am I geographically unhappy, but I might be unhappy with the way my voice is suppressed, or you know, I had a number of bosses for 15 years in the profession of football, including college, because that's like a job. It feels good not to have a boss, you know, like it just feels good to do what I want to do and answer to my family, and that's kind of it. And I can't do that. And I know some guys love NFL Network and ESPN and those sort of things. Not only do they you have to be controlled a little bit more in what you're talking about, where you're going, that sort of thing. But you're also geographically far away from home, and home is important to me.
I mean, it sounds like you're investing in yourself, you know, which is a great thing. Not, you know, a lot of people have the allure of other things, but I think, you know, a lot of the decisions you've made, I think, you know, talk about the kind of person you are and the way you see yourself post football. So,
well, you got to be a little selfish to be happy. And that's the thing is, like, you can't let other people just define your happiness and your success. And so some people might look at it and say, well, your podcast has got X amount of listeners, that sort of thing. You're going it on your own, and that sort of thing. Couldn't you have more if you joined, you know, The Ringer or Barstool or whatever? Yeah, but maybe that doesn't make me happy, you know?
Yeah,
and I'm going to be happy before I'd rather be happy than quote unquote successful, because I've done the success thing.
That's powerful. So thanks. Yeah. I think, one of the things also Dr. Curtis and I were, you know, talking back and forth last night, and, you know, we were kind of just trying to do some more research and pull some things out of your life and career. But, you know, I think you know, obviously your speech with the man of the year, that was personal to you and, you know, your family and even teammates and service members that got involved. But, you know, you said of all the evils in the world, apathy is one of the most dangerous. And I think, you know, given, you know, the challenges that we're going through in the country, both now and before, what's going on, whether it be COVID or some of the, you know, social issues going on, you know, I mean, do you think apathy actually plays into a part of that? That people are, you know, the people in certain positions are too apathetic, that we can all do more, I guess?
I think apathy is certainly very dangerous, because apathy You see people who, it's easy to spot evil, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to spot people who are just, you know, willfully being assholes, whether they're being racist or they're being selfish or they're being a whole host of things, oppressive, whatever it is. And if they do it loudly, it's easy. It's easy to spot those people. And the whole point is to improve and to not be content with how great of a place this is to live for me and my family. Like, I'm content with that. But if it's not like that for everybody, I'm not going to be apathetic. That's apathy, you know, to me.
Oh yeah.
And so there's being content, which is dangerous, and then there's being apathetic, which is very dangerous, because, you know, we need everybody if we want to improve where we live, some of the issues that we've talked about, if we want to get over the hump when it comes to something unprecedented like a pandemic, you know, which has just gotten us more divided. I really think that at the root of, you know, anything you're doing or saying, I would just, the way I at least live my life, and I don't like preaching to other people, but is if I'm looking in the mirror and I'm saying, am I just being a me guy? If I am, then I'm wasting my time, and I'm wasting everybody else's time, because apathy allows for all those easily identifiable evil forces and things to perpetuate. So I think it's sometimes we point at the people who are obviously assholes or obviously bad people or saying terrible things or reinforcing terrible things. But I'm looking at the people that, hey, come on, we need you in the fight.
Right. Yeah. No joke,
you know, and I know that you're not evil, but if you're apathetic, it's almost worse because you know better.
You know the problem, but you don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Hey, so. I was moved. Can you expand on that in relation to the concept of service to others? Because I was very moved by that same quote that Chris mentioned during the Walter Payton Award speech. You were talking also about, like, people sometimes think that their contribution is insignificant. I was just talking to a guy in clinic this morning that I mentioned some kind of, it was actually in conversation about one of your charities. And he says, well, that's good because that guy's, he's a big wheel. He can do that kind of thing. And I said, no, that's the point.
Yeah.
Anybody can contribute something. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Listen, I don't want to get too deep, but what are we here for? You know, like whether you believe in a God or you believe in being a productive member of society, whatever you think the end game is here, I just think that if everybody has the defeatist attitude that what I do doesn't matter, we wouldn't get anywhere. And I really believe that if we're going to advance the ball in any arena, everybody needs to be all hands on deck, because I could look at a Bill Gates and he could look at me, and if it's a salary contribution or if it's a tweet or if it's a day at the food bank or whatever we're doing, and somebody like Bill Gates could scoff, somebody like LeBron James could laugh, you know, like, and it goes down the line. I mean, I could look at somebody else's contribution and be like, well, it's much, much less than mine, but it doesn't matter because you're part of a chain. Like, you really are, whether you know it or not. What you do is not only important in a functional standpoint, whether it's a small donation or volunteering, it's also inspirational to other people.
That's right.
And, you know, before I was a football player, before I had a big platform, there are people that inspired me. And had those people had a defeatist attitude, because we're regular people, whether it was my little league coach, my high school coach, you know, a parent, a teacher, if everybody was just threw their hands up and said, well, I'm too regular to make a difference, not only are we not going to make a cumulative difference at the same rate, not even close, but you never know who you're going to inspire.
Right.
You know, so I think that's big. And I think it's big for football players to realize that, like, okay, I'm out of the game now. So things that I do, initiatives, they're not going to pack the same punch, and that's okay. It's about teamwork. It's about bringing people to the table. That's what we do with Water Boys, bringing other players to the table. That's what we do with Conquering Killy, bringing vets, you know, into the fight for clean water. It's about teamwork, but it's also about, you know, working faithfully and working faithfully that your contribution makes a difference. It's not for nothing, and that you might be that spark that makes a big change. So it's just such a defeatist attitude. It's like, why I get out of bed in the morning?
Right.
Like, then what's the point? Like, if you're going to tell me nothing you do matters,
right,
then stay inside.
Right.
You know, and there's days I feel like that, certainly, but you can't have a majority of days like that.
Right.
So, yeah, Chris, we want to be respectful of your time. So I'm going to let, if Dr. Curtis wants to ask another question, and then I was going to kind of wrap up. You have anything?
You're good, man. Cool? Yeah, totally.
Yeah, cool. Well, Chris, one thing, I was stoked to share your story with others because of all the charity work. If people want to get connected with your mission, because I got really excited about the Kilimanjaro trip. I was watching all those videos, and I'm thinking, dude, if this guy needs a medical team or a way team or whatever, I'm there.
We might.
I love that. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Go into those kind of places. But not only that, I watched this. I forget what the documentary was. I watched this huge documentary.
It had to be All the Way Up, because we don't have a lot of stuff out there. But yeah.
Yeah, that was it. And it was just amazing to me that there's people in the world that don't have water, all that. How do people connect with you, where do you want them to find you and your missions?
Well, we have an initiative called Water Boys. That is an alliance of pro athletes, veterans, entertainers, whoever. You know, everybody's welcome. And it's mainly fans, because we get most of our donations from smaller donations and that sort of thing, which I love. And again, to answer your question now, but also to harken back to that last question, is like, we have been able to provide clean water for upwards of almost 400,000 people. We've installed upwards of 100 large solar powered wells that serve communities of up to 7,500 people. And the majority of our donations come from small donations.
Nice.
So, awesome. You know, like, you've made a huge difference in my life. Like, fans have made a huge difference in the life of Water Boys. And countless initiatives we've done. We did an educational equity initiative when I was with the Eagles that got a lot of pub. It was, you know, to improve the conditions and the resources in schools that are predominantly Black. And I gave my part, and fans matched it with 1,000 small donations. So,
right,
you know, not only have they been the lifeblood, small contributions been the lifeblood of what we've done, but it answers your question, I think. And Water Boys is important to me. You can get on waterboys.org. We do work here domestically now. I know we started in East Africa because that's where I traveled. And by the way, I mean, like, I totally understand that we have a lot of issues that we need to solve in our country. But as y'all know, having traveled often to third world countries and that sort of thing, like, we've got it pretty good in a lot of ways as far as the resources that we enjoy. You know, we turn on the faucet and clean water comes out. Not everywhere, and that's what we're working to shed light on with our domestic program, Hometown H2O. But we started in East Africa, where waterborne illness is a reality. I mean, it's just everyone knows somebody that died from waterborne illness. It's a leading killer of kids under 5, and you know, it's stifling economic growth, educational growth. Kids are missing school, agriculture, sanitation. It's also a women's issue. Women and girls, you know, bear most of that burden, going to gather unclean or clean water, if they're lucky, from miles and miles away. And unspeakable things happen to these women and girls on that walk. So it's an exhaustive problem. There's also a solution that's exhaustive for society. It's one of the most, I don't get the word here in my head. It's because my brain's just fried. There's so many solutions that come out of providing clean water. You know, and all the things I just mentioned are remedied. You're saving lives, you're improving communities. So water is the main event with what we do. We've worked in East Africa. we're going to work domestically. We've crossed into basketball. We're crossing into the English Premier League. We've got veterans involved. It's all about building a team. And again, that's a we, not me thing. Otherwise, Waterboys could not be successful. And then also the fans making a ton of these quote-unquote insignificant contributions that you reference. They're not, because if everybody had that attitude, we probably aren't even sitting here talking about, hey, how'd you do this? How'd you do that? Well, I didn't do it. Everybody did it. And and so you can go to waterboys.org and check out information at the Chris Long Foundation website as well.
Well, Chris, thanks again for your time. You've been more than generous. And, you know, thanks for following up and keeping to your word and chatting with us. And we have a network that we've created both through Dr. Curtis's medical practice and, you know, my veteran community. It's called the Future Focus Health Network. So we'll make sure and share a lot about what we talked about and link to the Waterboys so that people can find out how they can get involved. So,
well, I appreciate that. I really do. And I appreciate, you know, I said this when we had our veteran dinner and that sort of thing. Our veteran community is, I look at it as, I think too many people just say thanks for your service and keep it moving. I certainly appreciate your service for anybody listening, but like, you're a powerful tool for our country, you know, out of uniform too. And we've had so many awesome vets with our Conquering Kelly initiative. So we want some more involved, all hands on deck. Check us out. We really appreciate you guys and girls.
Yeah. Thanks for your time, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you very much.